Hurricane Maria's devastation of Puerto Rico 2 years ago provided a catalyst for both education at the University of Oregon and relief for the survivors of the hurricane from the U of O. Those two threads meet in the person of our next guest. Alai Reyes Santos is an associate professor in the U of O's Indigenous Race and Ethnic Studies Department. She's also from Puerto Rico originally, and watching what the hurricane did to her homeland led to the formation of the Puerto Rico Project at the U of O. Project and creator are the subject of this month's edition of Curious, Research Meets Radio, our joint project with the university. Alai Reyes Santos, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Good to have you. You identify as an activist scholar. Where have you directed your activist energy in the past, before the hurricane?
I've done a lot of work with student activists working on accessible education for low-income students, especially over the past 20 years when cost of tuition has gone up. I've done a lot of migrant rights work, environmental justice work in the recent past, doing a lot of work around water, in particular in the state of Oregon. So that's a little bit of some of what I've been doing as an activist scholar over the past, 15 years.
All right. So certainly always having an eye on what we can do, not just how we can teach all this. And so how long since you left Puerto Rico?
I left Puerto Rico in 2001, so it's been around 18 years.
Mm-hmm. It's a good long time. What was it like watching the storm unfold from thousands of miles away?
I think heartbreaking is the word that summarizes it. It was just incredible to see this massive hurricane that everybody had feared for a long time. And people knew that the infrastructure was not going to be able to hold things together. Just hit it from far away and just feeling really powerless, really, really powerless. That's the big word that comes to mind.
Your mother apparently had said things in years past about a hurricane coming in from a certain direction, how she thought that would cause a real problem for Puerto Rico.
Yeah, since we were growing up as a child, she would just always pay attention whenever hurricane season came and pay attention to exactly the trajectory. And she always said if it hits us from the southeastern part of the island and it crosses over the island, we need to watch out. We need to be very careful. We don't know. That will be totally destructive. And so when I saw that happening that night as I was here in Oregon, and I saw exactly the trajectory, and at that moment I picked up the phone to call people and already saw someone were dead, I knew that it was going to be horrifying. But to be honest with you, I would have never expected the fact that we're still dealing with the consequences.
This many years later, 2 years later, we're still talking about it. So that's one of the major points here is like not only watching what the devastation was, but then, how long did it take to become clear to you that the relief efforts just weren't quite keeping up with the needs of the people?
Well, first of all, 3 weeks went by without even hearing if people were alive. Just the fact that we couldn't even get communication across from here to there, but also in the island itself. I would sometimes reach people in the cities, but they wouldn't be able to tell me if their family members 3 towns over were fine. The fact that suddenly it was in the news media, but it was clear that the government here in the U.S., they actually said, we're not going to send aid because Puerto Rico owes money to the federal government. Therefore, we are not going to be spending money there. So it was very clear from the beginning that the federal government's position was, we're not going to actually provide relief efforts in any substantive way. So that made it even worse than even feeling even more powerless to do anything at that particular moment in time. Yes.
Well, and you certainly didn't sit on your hands on this end of things. You quickly published an op-ed in the Register Guard called Why Should Oregon Care About Puerto Rico? What did you want to say there?
I basically wanted to educate Oregonians. Here in the Pacific Coast, people oftentimes do not even know that Puerto Rico exists, that it's a U.S. territory, that we are citizens. So I figured the least I could do here was to provide some information to people about the history of Puerto Rico, what did it mean that it's a U.S. territory, and its relationship to the history of the U.S., and why it should matter to Oregonians to advocate for Puerto Rico. And it was amazing because, to be honest with you, I wrote it thinking at least educate people and see if maybe they can at least support your foundation through letter writing. I never imagined that op-ed would get picked up in the way it did by media, both the mainstream media here in Oregon as well as the alternative media in Spanish, and also by lawmakers and other social justice activists here. I never imagined the impact that just 500 words would have on getting people to actually push also the federal government to provide relief efforts there.
So you really lit a fire under people from the sounds of it.
Yeah, I guess so. Yes, that is true. Well, I mean, to be honest, it felt more, I did it in a way just as a teacher and also as somebody who felt like I had to do something to emotionally sustain myself too in the process. And I'm just really thankful that other people were able to hear that message and actually gather and galvanize and organize themselves. And it was amazing. The response of Puerto Ricans in Oregon was beautiful. And all the people I met who I hadn't met before here, who immediately organized teachings, fundraisers, and ways of sending food directly to people there so that they wouldn't have to go to the warehouses where things got stuck for months and even a year without arriving to people. So that was really, really beautiful.
Now, that op-ed, again, that you published in the Register Guard was called Why Should Oregon Care About Puerto Rico? And it ticked off a series of points, and one of them was, we owe it to Puerto Rico. Describe that relationship and that particular aspect of it.
Well, for me, first of all, the ways in which Puerto Ricans have been central to the political life of this country, served in the military, in each military kind of like plan that we've had over the past 100 years, anywhere we've been in the military, Puerto Ricans have served in really incredible ways. The ways in which we also have been the center of like creating diplomacy and treaties throughout Latin America and the Caribbean with the U.S. I mean, there's something really strategic about Puerto Rico's location in relationship to the East Mainland. The fact that our economic status has been sadly greatly diminished by the relationship with the U.S., the way that U.S. farming subsidies has destroyed the agricultural economy of Puerto Rico and continues to do so in such a way that Puerto Rican farmers continue to struggle to sell their food because U.S. subsidized foods make it really hard for them to sell food in the market. We can talk also about all the pharmaceutical companies where a lot of drugs that are actually consumed in the U.S. are produced in Puerto Rico and tested in Puerto Rico. We can talk about the pill that was actually tested on Puerto Rican women without their authorization, and that's how we have a pill now as a contraceptive in the U.S. and many other places. So there's all these ways in which we owe Puerto Rico for many of the things that we experience in the U.S., but also in the way that the U.S. relates to Latin America and the Caribbean.
So a testing ground, a place for experimentation, but still no statehood.
Still in the
state, yes. Right. Alai Reyes Santos is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange and Associate Professor of Ethnic Studies at the University of Oregon. We're talking about Hurricane Maria and its effect on her native Puerto Rico and how she galvanized student response on the Oregon end of things. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. This is this month's edition of Curious Research Meets Radio. 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I was trying to put together the timeline in my head, Alai, and I realized that all the events, the devastation of Puerto Rico, the clarity about the fact that the relief was taking a long time and was insufficient, all this would have happened just days before classes started in 2017. I mean, do you remember a particular event or moment when you said, I have to make this part of class work, or was that in your mind from the get-go?
Actually, to be honest with you, I was quite in shock and also feeling that I didn't have enough information that first week, those first 2 weeks as I was like preparing for classes to begin. It was, I think, after week one, after 2 or 3 weeks of not hearing from people and feeling that nothing was happening from the U.S. side, that I went to my class that morning and I said, you know, this is happening in Puerto Rico. This is the little information we have. And to be honest, a lot of the information was coming from the capital, from San Juan, and I am from the countryside and from the mountain range. And I just kept wondering what's happening in the mountain range. I knew that there had to be landslides, for example, but you were not getting all of that information from those communities. So I shared with my students, this is what's happening. People don't have water. People don't have food. People don't have roofs. I kept hearing reports of people getting really sick in their lungs because of pollution. And so I had friends sleeping in their roofs because that was the only place where they could sleep. They had bees and wasps all over their houses because those bees and wasps had lost their refuge. So I just shared all those things with them, and suddenly, to be honest with you, together as a class, we decided that we wanted to do something. And then the student began to imagine. I remember I had them do group work, and they all began to come up with different ideas. A few of them wanted to fundraise. A few of them wanted to go to Puerto Rico in kind of a delegation to bring the aid directly. A few of them wanted to document stories. And then that's how we came up with the idea of a website together. And actually, one of the students who's part of student government immediately wrote the student government people, and they said, we will fund for a number of students to actually travel there. So wow. I have to say, I don't like to take credit for the class because I feel like it was only possible because the students were so engaged. And they themselves came up with ideas about how we could do the work together.
You know, the class is called Race, Ethics, Justice. So, you know, obviously a good place to talk about these sorts of things. But I understand that particular year in the fall quarter of 2017, more students had enrolled?
Yes, I have to say, it was a new class. The first time I had, I think, maybe 10 students, possibly 12. But that particular year, because they heard about it from the previous year, I had at least 25, 28. And so I had double the amount of students. And, you know, when I asked them why they were in the class, they just said, when we saw the title and we heard about what you did last year, we felt like it would be a class where we could really engage the things that matter to us right now. We could do something that would make an impact when we see so many harsh things happening in the world.
So how deal with the day-to-day lessons of what kinds of things you were trying to get across about the things that happen to people of certain ethnic groups because they are in those ethnic groups when something that you would think wouldn't, you know, show favorites or enemies, natural disasters, hit those ethnic groups?
Yeah, well, some of what we discussed in the class part of what we discovered in our work was we met with an organization of Dominican migrant women in Puerto Rico. And a lot of the work I did for my first book was about migration in the Caribbean and in Puerto Rico and about Dominican migrants being discriminated against oftentimes. And so we discovered that actually a lot of Dominican neighborhoods were not even being visited by officials, like government officials in Puerto Rico. That they were being like blatantly ignored. So if there was water being given away in a community, they will not receive the water, for example. So that was one of the issues that we discussed, how ethnicity and migrant status was shifting. Even the little aid that was being made accessible was not being made accessible for them. We also talk about Black-identified Puerto Rican communities and how also, because they tend to be imagined as criminalized, that those are criminal neighborhoods, they should be afraid of walking into those spaces. Also, relief efforts wouldn't find a way into those communities. And definitely the rural communities, which some of them with very strong indigenous Taino history. Those people, some of those we visited, for example, in Jauco, they told us, we have seen the mayor once, FEMA once, with a helicopter throwing water at us. We never saw anybody else again. Everything else we have here, we gathered to our own family members in other towns, people who've come and helped us, but none of what you see here, this food, this milk for babies, came from a government aid. So we were able to talk in class about how relief efforts don't actually even, they do not get distributed to everyone in the same way.
No, okay. Let's take some phone calls here. We have William in Sutherland on the line. Sutherland, rather. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Alai Reyes Santos from the University of Oregon.
Yeah, I have a question for the lady. When I took my Peace Corps training in 63, I went to Puerto Rico, and we were working in a self-help housing program, building supposedly hurricane-proof houses. They were all built out of concrete, reinforced concrete, including the roof. And I'm really curious to know how they stood up.
And which part of the, where were they built? Do you remember, Bill?
I don't remember where we were at. We actually were pretty much all over the island at one time or another.
Okay, let's see if Alai knows anything about that. What do you say?
Well, actually, it's interesting. I remember the time when the construction changed to concrete, and a lot of houses made it okay. However, some of the challenges we have is that even concrete houses, because of how the hurricane how the intensity of the hurricane, those houses got filled with water. And so sometimes it wasn't that people lost their roof, it's that they either lost windows or they had so much water coming in that their houses were full of mildew and mold. And so they're unlivable. that actually literally unlivable. And people in those unlivable conditions were living, all these elderly people, people with chronic asthma, breathing mildew and mold. I mean, they continue to be because a lot of houses haven't been restored. I mean, 30,000 households still have tarps in Puerto Rico right now.
30,000 still?
30,000, okay. Yes.
And how many were damaged altogether?
I believe that 90% of the island's houses were damaged in some way or another. At least 90% of households applied for FEMA funding because their houses were damaged one way or another. The water damage was completely destructive and a hazard for health conditions for sure.
Let's take another phone call. Misha in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Ali Reyes Santos.
I think this is the thing here of like racism, because what's happened is people are probably aware after Hurricane Katrina happened, people were talking about New Orleans. They were talking about this toughness, this meanness, this racism. Maybe they shouldn't rebuild New Orleans because maybe the thing is there were a lot of quote-unquote Afro-Americans there, and the people didn't care about them. And I know that, like, when there was a situation with the problem in the one Chinatown, whether there's a thing about some disease, the people burned down, they were thinking about...
Oh, in San Francisco,
In San Francisco. But they had done that in another place. But to me, it's a thing of like racism, like certain people aren't treated quite right, kind of like after the Spanish after, for example, a lot of Mexican Americans had their land taken away in California. They had their land stolen. So I think that's just another thing of racism, that people aren't getting together the way that we should.
All right. Thanks for that, Misha. Appreciate it. Thoughts from you, Ali?
I mean, sadly, the truth is that racism impacts so much of our lives every day, but in particular, thinking about environmental issues and natural disasters, there's plenty proof that it is communities of color, communities experience racism, that experience economic violence and environmental and natural disaster issues at a higher rate. I mean, we can think about Flint, Michigan. We can look even here in Eugene, Oregon, where when you look at lead in housing, it is oftentimes migrant communities that are exposed at a higher rate to lead in painting and housing or toxic water to their pipes. And so that is just one example of how racism impacts the fact that we don't think, we need to handle that issue because it is just those communities that are experiencing them. When we think also about infrastructure, where do we invest in building housing that actually will sustain natural disaster, housing that's clean for children to be able to live in them, that is free from the danger of landslides, for example, which is part of what happened in Puerto Rico, is the poorest communities that got hit the hardest because they were living in places that themselves were not built the right way because they were not considered to be communities where money had to be invested in them. So definitely racism and poverty play a role in how is it that people experience the impact of natural disasters and environmental issues.
So in starting the Puerto Rico Project at the University of Oregon, what came first? Did you begin to start the blogging and then take the trip with the pictures? Or how did, I'm just curious about the order of events there.
No, actually, we first of all began the process of training students. First of all, having students apply to go to Puerto Rico, taking the students who were going, training them with Professor Ana Maria Lara, who's an anthropologist here, and she trained them on how you do interviews in a natural disaster because she had worked in Haiti after the earthquake in 2010. Then in the meantime, students were doing research, creating PowerPoints that people could use for fundraisers with just basic Puerto Rico history and what was happening with the hurricane, because people kept asking us to give presentations, but we just didn't have the capacity. Mm-hmm. So we thought people could just use the PowerPoints to present themselves and educate themselves. And then we went to Puerto Rico, brought all those suitcases, the 12, 15 suitcases, funding, and also interviewed people. And then winter and spring, I had a few students continue working with me as interns, and then that's how we created the website. So it took us a whole year to be able to actually produce the website that exists right now.
So how many students from the U of O altogether went to Puerto Rico?
We had 3 students when we moved to Puerto Rico.
Okay, all right.
Yes.
And how many times have you been back since the hurricane?
I've been back. Actually, that's the one time I was back. I haven't been back since, actually. Mm-hmm. Yes, for many personal reasons, actually. I lost my mom to gun violence, and so that's another story.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
So I mean, do you feel like you made any kind of a dent in the situation that you were able to help enough people to make a difference in their lives?
You know, what people said when we went was that it was amazing to receive the water filtration systems, the food items. I mean, they felt they were so thankful, the money. But that what was more important to them is to feel that other people were listening to them and their stories, that they were not forgotten. And I when I say this, I get teary-eyed because everybody would just receive us with so much love. And everywhere we went, people would give us the best food they had, the little coffee they had. Everywhere we went, people received it with such openness. My students were just moved, so moved, because they said, wow, people suffering so much are giving us what they have. But what they said that we were giving them was a chance to tell their story, to be heard, and at times to connect with other people in the island. Because part of what we discovered traveling throughout the island is that people didn't know what was happening in different parts. And so as we were traveling, we were able to share stories. So in this town that's happening, the other part that's happening. And people began to get a sense of the whole picture. So I feel like the website was great to give something for people to teach and share and get a sense of what was happening in the mountain region in particular. But for people who we developed this relationship with, they felt that what was the most important was the human connection and the getting their voices heard.
So not so much the delivering of the food and the water, but you know, that helps, obviously, but just being able to receive their story and listen to them. People love to get listened to, don't they?
They do. That's why they love radio. We get to share stories.
That is good. All right, the Puerto Rico Project is online. We link to it at our website at jeffexchange.org. Alai Reyes Santos is an associate professor of ethnic studies at the University of Oregon and the creator of the Puerto Rico Project. Thank you so much for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, good to have you.